Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
KMOX.
Listen anytime, anywhere.
Get the radio.com app today.
Would you walk us through a typical day?
Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's.
Stop spending!
I'm president, and you're not.
This is the greatest country in the world, but we do have some really stupid people representing it from time to time.
I am proud to shut down the government. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I don't think he's a smart person, but he's got a loud voice.
On KMOX.
Yes, thank you, Mr. President. I appreciate that. As we are often running here on a Tuesday afternoon edition of the Mark Reardon Show, lots to get to as usual. But let's start with our good buddy, Steve Templeton, who should just be sort of a regular part of the show. We got to get you on a better contract here to have my people talk to you people, because you're with me half the time here to start off these days.
I'm tired of starting it off with winter weather. Really
I know. Am. I think a lot of people are. So what are we looking at now?
So look, this isn't a winter storm per se. It's a quick hit of winter weather, snow and a winter mix. But I'll tell you what, if you're going to be driving anywhere from around 7 o'clock to midnight in the St. Louis area, that's when it could impact your travel. It may come down heavy briefly. So 7 to midnight is the bulk of the accumulation in the metro. It'll be earlier to the south. Exact start times still uncertain. It's not exact 7 o'clock. It may be more like 8 or 9, but it's in that evening time period through midnight to watch for impacts on travel. Then we get into a transition. It's not just snow, but it may be sleet and then freezing rain. And the more sleet and freezing rain we get, would cut the snow totals depending on how much of a mix versus a pure snow. Right now, I think 1 to 2 inches is a good range because it comes down so heavy. But again, if there's more sleet in there, that's going to be much lower. Bottom line is, shortly after midnight, temperatures are actually rising and getting above freezing. And so we won't have any lingering problems for the Wednesday morning commute. There'll be some drizzle. The roads will be wet. But again, if you're traveling this evening, and in particular, you're coming out of the Blues game tonight, you could have some tough travel. Probably around 10 o'clock or so, heading home.
Well, and that would be what to look at. I think we might get off, just listening and interpreting what you said, we might get off easy here for the evening commute, but then things get tricky after that. So I think that would be, we're extrapolating some good news out of this, Steve, and I think the timing of this might be good news.
Yeah, but for anyone driving later this evening, just be careful. It's a quick hit, comes down heavy. We'll pull out of it tomorrow morning. We'll be just wet on the roads.
All right, Steve, we'll talk to you later this afternoon.
Take care.
News 4's Chief Meteorologist Steve Templeton. As I get to a couple of things that I want to talk about, first and foremost, I'm excited to speak with my pal, and I've always said he's one of my favorite people on the planet because he is Coach Norm Stewart. Derek Chivas' number is going to be retired at Mizzou Arena tonight. 31 years ago, his career came to an end in 1988. And for those younger people who might not know the Band-Aid Man, he wore a Band-Aid on a part of his body when he played every game. And he ended up, I got the numbers in front of me here, and this was my era of Mizzou basketball. I graduated '86, was working in the media after that, and, started sitting at the press table at Mizzou basketball games in probably '87, right when, Chivas was in the peak of his career. So he still holds the records for career points, 2,580, single season points, 820, which, by the way, when you think about the points, let me put this into perspective. I'd have to double check. I'm pretty sure that the three-pointer wasn't even in existence in the first couple of years Derek Chivas was at Mizzou. I have to check on that, but I'm pretty sure he scored a lot of those points without having the ability to score three-pointers. Single season points, 821, 86, 87. Career scoring average for a four-year player, 19.9. But it was interesting, and Coach Stewart can weigh in on this. I saw there was a piece in the Post-Dispatch about Derek where he was interviewed. He still lives in Columbia, too, which I think is amazing. And he commented how he was talking to Lynn Hardy, who was another teammate of his during that period, but they never made it out of the, first round of the NCAA tournament. I still remember getting my tickets for the Xavier game, or the weekend that they were playing Xavier in Indianapolis. That would have been probably 87. And they lost to Xavier. This is back when Xavier was really, nobody had ever heard of Xavier. We didn't know how to pronounce it. Was it Xavier or Xavier? And they upset Mizzou. And of course, we know all the other the other things that followed after that. So Coach Stewart is coming up. Here's something that I'm going to stay on top of, topic-wise here. And I've been talking about it for a while. You might remember, longtime listeners of the show, and you don't have to go back too long, just back to last year when they passed the tax cut. I warned my friends in the congressional delegation, like Congressman Roddy Davis and Ann Wagner and Congressman Shimkus, and I said, hey, you guys realize that there is the potential here for this tax cut that you're passing to really kind of backfire on you in April of 2019. They would say, why is that? Well, because when I'm doing the math here, what you guys are putting together, I'm pretty convinced that there are a lot of people in this country that are going to be paying more in taxes in April of 2019 than less in taxes. Now, let's distinguish the difference here because you have a lot of stories coming out about smaller tax refunds. Well, that doesn't mean that your tax burden went up. That might mean that you have a smaller refund because you were required to pay less in taxes, your rate went down, the withholding tables adjusted, you don't get as big a refund. That bums people out. They're looking for that refund, you know, sort of depend on it. But that's not necessarily how it's supposed to work because most people, I think the financial folks would say, well, maybe don't give the government all your money to spend and then you don't get as much of a refund. But it's a mental game sometimes that people have to get through. Now, that's one scenario. But I am coming across plenty of scenarios so far, and it's early in tax season. I've heard from some listeners. I've heard from some friends. I've talked to my accountant to see what he's experiencing. And I think it does go in both directions to a certain extent. But what we're finding is there are a lot of people out there that are paying more and they're having to cut big checks. So keep an eye on that because I think that's going to be a big problem for Republicans. And I've been predicting it for a long time. And there really isn't going to be anyone else to blame but the president and the Republicans on that. Could be wrong. We will see. I just think it's something I've telegraphed for a while, and I think it's coming to fruition. I got to talk a little bit about this movie. I'm so excited because, ladies and gentlemen, let me explain something to you. You may have read To Kill a Mockingbird and other great pieces of American literature. There is no better piece of American literature or book on the planet, just definitively, there's no argument here, no debate whatsoever, than the book by Motley Crue called The Dirt, which came out, I think, more than a decade ago. And they announced finally that they're ready to make the movie, where they made the movie and they're going to release it here on Netflix. And I'm a little confused because there was a trailer that came out today. You got, you know, Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil and Tommy Lee and Mick Mars. And the book basically had the story of Motley Crue. And let me just say this just to, you know, get a start. I'm not even a big Motley Crue fan, but I read that book and I was just blown away by the level of debauchery and decadence. You think that your life, I thought my life was kind of decadent in the 1980s because I did dabble in some things that were decadent. Nothing like these guys, rock stars at the top of their game. So for those people who read it, it was called The Dirt Confessions of the World's Most Notorious Rock Band. And one of the things that made it interesting is that each member of Motley Crue told their version of the same story to a certain extent. And their memories were different because of the drugs and the alcohol and just, you know, memories play tricks on you. So just looking at a quick glance at the trailer, it looked pretty good. And it doesn't look, one of my main criticisms of Bohemian Rhapsody was they sanitized it. They made a PG-13 movie out of an R-rated story. This is an NC-17 rated story that hopefully they made an R-rated movie out of. I don't know if they could go as far as the book did because that would, although that'd be interesting, but I think they cast a bunch of no-names, which I like because I think you cast people that you're familiar with in some of these movies. And Rami Malek was sort of well-known, you know, because of The Robot Show or whatever that was, Mr. Robot or iRobot. iRobot was a movie, or Mr. Robot. So he was still good as Freddie Mercury. I just didn't like the movie because they sanitized the story. So keep an eye out for The Dirt. Let me see if this says. I think it's just streaming, which is kind of interesting. I thought they'd get a theatrical release, but this one looks like it's just going to come on Netflix on March 22nd, which, look, you're going to see more and more of that. Let me talk about Jesse Smollett and where we're at with that right now. We had Rafer Weigel on yesterday from Fox 32 in Chicago. He's been on top of this story from the beginning. And there have not been a lot of changes in the past 24 hours. The the word from the Chicago PD is it looks like, you know, we're finding out from the two guys that were in the video that were the Nigerian brothers who worked on, one of them worked on the set of Empire. He was hired by Jesse to be a personal trainer or whatever. And, you know, the story evolved here in the past couple of weeks. It's been very clear that he made this whole thing up. And what we think happened at this point, according to the Chicago Police Department and sources and the reporting out of Chicago, is he sent this letter to himself a week before that. That's what it looks like. Well, somebody sent a letter that threatened him. It looks like it was written by a third grader. It literally looks like it was written by a third grader. That did not get a lot of attention. The police sources say, look, he wanted more attention from that. He staged this to get more attention. Who knows what all the motivation was. So some of us from the very beginning knew that this did not pass the sniff test. Although I said from the very beginning, as I have in many, many other stories, I'm going to wait and see how this one works out. Because what you don't want to do, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, every Democrat politician, every lefty Hollywood person, is come out of the chute and start ripping on the president and the president's supporters and the climate in this country, the hateful white men in particular who do not like gay black actors. You don't want to come out of the gate, you know, criticizing all that, because when you shoot from the hip, often you shoot yourself in the foot. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And they're all kind of backing off and they're not even saying anything because they know it's embarrassing. So Chris Ciliza at CNN wrote about this, and this is amazing. And we're going to talk about, I have a great segment planned for this afternoon on media bias from Laura Logan, who was a longtime CBS reporter, worked on 60 Minutes. She sat down for a podcast last week that's getting a lot of attention because she talked about explicit media bias. And she knows it well because she's been a television journalist for a long time. And it's important to hear what Laura has to say. But Ciliza, this relates to the bias overall. He writes this column and he talks about how Kamala Harris called it an attempted modern-day lynching and Cory Booker said the same exact thing. Kristen Gillibrand said, this is a sickening and outrageous attack, and horribly, it's the latest of too many hate crimes against LGBTQ people and people of color. And it went on and on and on and on, right? So what Ciliza said is, okay, that's what the liberals did, but what the conservatives did is they, you know, kind of took it on themselves without waiting for the facts as well. He said that the news of what happened, you know, the truth that is coming out and emerging right now, he says, led to a massive conservative counterattack on Democrats and the media, who they will argue were all too willing to cast Smollett as the victim of an attack, even though corroborating evidence was short supply. So the left attacked without waiting. This is Ciliza. The left attacked without waiting for the facts. The right counterattacked based on what police told the media after an investigation of the case. Now, that's not, I'm sorry, that's the question that I'm posing, all right? And this was posted on Hot Air. So if the left attacked, didn't wait for the facts, didn't know what really happened, and then those of us on the right counterattacked, from the beginning we said, well, this doesn't pass the smell test, but let's see what happened. There's the possibility that the guy was attacked. I said that numerous times. And then we respond based on what the police are actually saying. Is that the same thing? Well, Chris Ciliza says that it is. And he writes, politics has become so base-centric in the last decade-ish. Politicians are forever on the hunt for stories that confirm what their base already believes. If they can be the first or loudest voice in condemnation, they believe that helps them, especially when they're running for the president or for president. And he says Democratic candidates were quick to believe Smollett's version, and now Republicans, especially those aligned with the Trump White House, are just as quick to seize on the idea that this was all an elaborate hoax. Both sides are simply exhibiting confirmation bias. No, they're not exhibiting confirmation bias. What the folks on the left are doing is exhibiting confirmation bias. The folks on the right are saying, hey, this never made any sense to begin with, and now the actual facts of the case are coming out, and they have been leaking out in the past couple of weeks, that don't add up anywhere near to the version of the story that Jesse Smollett told not only the whole country, but Chicago police, and was defended mercilessly from those on the left because he was a victim. Well, the victim were the American people and the Chicago Police Department and all the resources they had to use in a city where they have a bunch of murderers. So the whole notion that Chris Cillizza and the folks from CNN think that that amounts to the same thing is beyond ludicrous and ridiculous. And we'll get to the Laura Logan stuff a little bit later this afternoon. Bernie Sanders is back in the race for president. We'll run that down here in just a couple of minutes on KMOX. I was listening this morning when Dr. Terry Jones was on with Charlie Brennan. He wrote a piece late last week that got a little attention on social media about the Better Together plan and raising all sorts of questions. He was on with Charlie. I have some audio from that, and Dave Leipold's from Better Together to respond to some of those statements and the, you know, the, I don't want to say allegations, but certainly the case that those opposed to the merger are making against it. So we'll talk with Dave here in just a couple of minutes. I did mention the Laura Logan stuff. I have to get to that. Very important about the, you know, the Media Bias podcast. He was on with this guy talking about bias, was very, very candid about it. So we'll get to that. And also, you know, I mentioned this story just briefly yesterday about this guy in Minneapolis named Jerry Westrum, who was arrested for a murder in 1993. He's a successful businessman, and they found some DNA that they thought might match up with him because he was a suspect. He threw a napkin away, I think it was at a hockey game, his daughter's hockey game or something like that, and they found the napkin, and now he faces murder charges. Dan O'Neill will also be here this afternoon to talk about the Blues, red hot, and I also mentioned Coach Norm Stewart, longtime Hall of Fame basketball coach for my Mizzou Tigers, talking about Derek Chivas and his number being retired tonight in that game, which is bound to be a real nail-biter with Kentucky at Missouri. Every once in a while, though, the Tigers will throw in a surprise. Maybe that'll happen tonight. All right, so Bernie Sanders is now once again in the race for president. Susan Milligan is with me this afternoon. She's a senior political writer for U.S. News and World Report. I'm going to talk about that and also some of the other members in what's becoming an extremely crowded field. Susan, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. We have this deal on KMOX in the morning called KMOX Overtime, and I was on this morning where we kind of talk issues back and forth, and this Bernie Sanders topic came up from the perspective of, well, how will this work in 2020 compared to his very successful campaign? Didn't win the race, obviously, but there's no denying the impact and the success he had, especially with younger voters in 2016. So I think it can go in a couple of directions. Could be been there, done that. We want to see some of the new, bright, shiny objects. Or, look, he's got the name recognition. He has the infrastructure. He's got the base, you know, his own base outside of the Democratic base. So what would the anticipation be for his campaign moving forward?
Well, I think you're right on all counts, actually. It could go, he's got some real strengths and he's got some real liabilities. The thing to remember about the 2016 campaign is that Sanders was the anti-establishment candidate, and which was kind of ironic. He was the, you know, older white guy, and here is the first, you know, female nominee who ended up being the nominee, who was the establishment candidate. But he could position himself as like the person who stood up to sort of the rigged economy, or you know, just whatever people thought was going wrong with the way Washington was going. And now he can't do that because there are simply too many other people kind of like him in the race who are like that. And arguably some of them might have advantages he doesn't have. For example, Sanders had a big problem with African-American voters in 2016, and I'm not sure he's going to improve on that much this time around, particularly when you've got Cory Booker in the race, when you've got Kamala Harris in the race, and so forth. The second thing is this isn't the greatest year to be a white guy in the race for if you're a Democrat.
Well, it's not a great year to be a white guy, period, as a white guy. I'm just going to say it's not the best decade for white guys.
Versus women's, and we can disagree on that. I mean, it's actually still pretty good to be a white guy. But it isn't, you know, look, the reason that the Democrats took the House back in 2018 was because of female candidates and candidates of color. In fact, white men are now the decided minority of the Democratic caucus in the House, and you know that hasn't been true for very long. So it's not a great year to be a white guy who doesn't represent something new. I mean, I'm not saying I think Beto O'Rourke would be the strongest candidate, because you know he lost, he came very close to winning a Senate seat actually in Texas, which is amazing, and I'd be interested to see what happened, for example, if he decided to challenge John Cornyn in 2020. But at least Beto O'Rourke has, you know, it looks like he's on the way up. You know, he's got this tremendous appeal among young voters. But that being said, so does Bernie Sanders, and he's got a lot of small donors who have already committed to him. He's got a very passionate, loyal base out there. I mean, I saw it in 2016. It wasn't enough to get him the nomination, but I saw it then. But keep in mind, he's not a Democrat. That's the other thing.
That's an important point, right?
Well, it is an important point, and you know, it was sort of irritating actually to hear some complaints during the 2016 campaign that somehow Hillary Clinton had this rigged her advantage, you know, because they did this in this state and this in this state. It's like, okay, but if you were a Democrat and you actually knew what the rules were, you might have been able to compete with her on that level. I mean, there were people who showed up, for example, in the caucuses in Nevada who didn't understand why they couldn't show up and be delegates for Sanders, and they weren't registered in advance, but some of them were not even registered to vote. So, this is part of the problem when you don't, you know, again, he has a tremendous base of support. He said some things in 2016. He's still saying the same thing that appeals, I think, now to an even wider group of Democrats, Medicare for all. He talked about tuition-free public colleges and universities. I don't know where that happened, but at least something that gets it closer to that. And he's for the Green New Deal and so forth. So, but the thing is, he's not the only person running now who feels that way.
Well, and, you know, I was looking at some polling this morning, and in the Emerson poll that just came out says Uncle Joe's at 27%. That's providing that Biden gets in the race. Sanders 17. But look at the numbers right behind him. Kamala Harris at 15. Elizabeth Warren 9. Cory Booker at 9. So there's a lot of room here. And my expectation, just even seeing the initial polling, would be that Bernie's probably not going to be able to hang too tight with these candidates. But let's talk about Kamala Harris, who's sort of come out of this maybe as one of the favorites for the nomination, not altogether because of maybe the power of her name recognition or whatever these things might be, but the California primary date means a lot in this race, doesn't it?
It does, but I mean, I'd really discount the schedule, frankly, as a decider, to use a Bush term here, the decider. It used to be way back in the olden days, meaning when I was first covering presidential campaigns, that it really mattered if you won early contests. Because I remember covering Bill Clinton's race in 1992. It's like you really had to win a state to get people, sustain the interest so that people would send in their checks so you could get, you know, the bus fare to go to the next state. That's not the case anymore. And a lot of that changed when Barack Obama started raising money online and with people texting on their phones. That's also where he got a lot of young people to vote. This has an impact, by the way, in two ways. One, and nobody has done any study on this that I know of, but all political scientists and analysts seem to agree on this, Democrat and Republican, that if somebody makes a contribution to a campaign, they're more likely to show up to vote because they have literally invested in the campaign, even if it's just $5 in a text.
That makes sense, right.
Right. But you're not going to, most people wouldn't send in a check for $5, but you might do it if it's like, oh, just text this to this number and you've contributed $5. So that's how candidates can raise money very, very quickly. Remember, Rand Paul raised $6 million in a 24-hour period. So what you used to need in the past to get momentum, you don't anymore. And keep in mind also that the Democratic primary is not winner take all for states. The Republicans, I think it's mixed, but there are more that way. The Democrats are proportional. So, yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, Kamala Harris can do very well in California for obvious reasons, and her opening rally was just enormously attended. But it is early, and I'd like to caution people that, you know, we love to look at polls, and I complain about polls, but I also love to look at polls. But at this stage, a lot of it's name recognition. A lot of it is just something that somebody said that kind of caught fire on social media.
You just never know. You know, I think going back to your 92 example, I think you could have, now look, times have changed and media has changed, but you could have said, who, this Bill Clinton guy, how does this guy from Arkansas expect to win, you know, against George Bush? And he sort of, to a certain extent, came out of nowhere. Now, there were different factors, obviously, Arkansas, as opposed to being a governor of California or something like that. But Susan, it's going to be interesting, and it's going to hurt our brains, I think, moving forward for a variety of reasons to watch this field take shape and see the debate. Susan Milligan, who is a senior political writer for U.S. News and World Report. I appreciate it, Susan. Thank you so much.
Great to be on. Anytime.
All right, take care. And the good news is you're going to be able to get to the Blues game, hopefully with little or no difficulty, but then it'll take you 5 hours to get home because all the weather's moving in while you're at the game. But it's worth it if the Blues win again, right? All right, so we are going to exhaustively talk about the Better Together merger from now until Election Day, November 2020, provided that it lands on the ballot. And there's all kinds of back and forth, and I've been trying to cover this from a relatively fair position because I'm pretty open-minded on this, and I would say I'd put myself in the camp of someone who supports it more than doesn't support it, at this time. However, you know, there's all kinds of perspectives that are coming out. And what I think is helpful is once a perspective comes out from either side, maybe we have a discussion, we talk about it. So Terry Jones, who is University of Missouri, St. Louis, public policy professor emeritus, wrote a piece about the plan. It was highly critical, and he went on with Charlie Brennan this morning. Let me just play this, because obviously, and some of this is going to go over territory that we've discussed before, but maybe with a little nuance. So people are concerned, Terry Jones is concerned about, you have this statewide vote, and then that excludes people here in St. Louis City and St. Louis County from ultimately perhaps having a say.
So we could end up with a very awkward and inappropriate and indeed undemocratic feature of having a statewide vote where the state people outside the city and the county wanted us to have the new kind of government, but we in the city and the county did not want it.
And if we just might take a look around the corner, how will that generally play out if people feel that they have been that a government has been forced upon them? How do Americans typically react to that?
They don't trust that government. They have little confidence in it, and they don't give it their support.
All right, so that's one of the concerns, and I mentioned the Better Together folks willing to come on here and respond to some of this. Dave Leipholz, who is one of the attorneys working with Better Together, was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and they rolled this out, is with me this afternoon. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So did you hear the whole interview with Terry this morning? You read his piece, I'm guessing.
I did. I heard, went back and listened to some chunks of it. Certainly some interesting, erroneous, but interesting assertions.
All right, well, we'll go down that. But on the assertion of what he said there, that's something obviously that's been repeated. I've expressed concern about that. At this point, I don't know if there's anything that you can say about that other than this is the process moving forward, and I guess we'll have a competing process with the freeholders situation. But do you have a reaction to that? Because that's obviously still maybe first and foremost outside of people saying in St. Louis County that we're just taking on the problems of the city. That's the number one complaint that I still think confuses people.
Yeah, I think that, you know, with the statewide vote, it is something that sticks out and it's odd. People's natural reaction is, you know, I think what a lot of ours was, which is, why do you have to do it this way? But the important thing we remind people is, the reason you have to do the constitutional amendment, and Terry even alludes to this in his comments, is that to consolidate public safety, to do what we want to do, to address the fact that the city and county are divided in our constitution, and people, that's the part we're starting from. And to do that, and to do the public finance reform especially, you have to do the constitutional amendment. And he even says as much. He says, you know, if they were willing to make changes to their recommendations, then they could do a board of freeholders. And that, to me, concedes that, you know, to do those things, he knows we can't. And so is it different than it was in other places that have done this? Some. But even in Indianapolis, there wasn't any vote. Their legislature did it. And so, you know, you really have to start and embrace the realities of where you are and not just have a philosophical debate about it.
But that's going to be still a marketing challenge for Better Together, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's going to be, process has been what opponents have always driven at us. And I think that we have to respond to those critiques and to educate people on them. But I think it also indicates they know that the status quo is indefensible and what we have isn't working. And so we're going to have to continue to educate folks. And that's, you know, over the next 2 years, that's our job. This is not something that comes in a week or 2 weeks. We're going to be really open and honest about these conversations and try and educate people on why we're doing it a certain way and not just what's in it.
So the transparency moving forward is absolutely something that I appreciate and I think people appreciate, but there are some questions about transparency when this was all being put together. And if you had a freeholder process, it would be public. This was a comment this morning.
Better Together is not a democratically elected group or appointed by people who are democratically elected.
It's self-appointed.
Are their meetings public?
No.
Their deliberations are quite private.
They were.
And their emails and documents and anything they use are not subject to sunshine laws, correct?
Well, they are not.
Okay. So, but the Board of Freeholders would be in all those cases.
It's a public body, and therefore it's subject to all of those conditions.
All right, Dave, that does not sit well with people. The lack of the, you know, the open process leading to this report and this recommendation.
Yeah, I think that Terry is trying to compare us to a legislative body, which we're doing an initiative petition, which is a citizen's route to put something on the ballot. And oddly enough, I haven't heard him critiquing any of the other initiative petitions that fly through Missouri year after year. It just so happens that when one comes up that addresses the municipal system he's been working in for decades, that's where his philosophical leanings take him somewhere else. But, you know, this is something we've had publicly. We have done over just with the task force alone. We've met with thousands of people, 500 leaders of different entities. Better Together has been around for 5 years and interacted, met with 18,000 people. So I would actually challenge him to find an initiative petition or effort that has done even half of the outreach that we've done in crafting this plan, because he just won't do it.
You mentioned that you listened to the interview and you read the piece, and there were, I think your word was erroneous, but what in his analysis of this plan would you challenge?
I mean, first and foremost, I think, you know, some things like what he's saying about the charter and that the county executive and the mayor write it, and they're allowed to amend. What happens is the county charter serves at the base as the basis, so it's not this brand new thing all of a sudden, but the mayor and the county executive do get to put forth recommendations on reorganization and structure, but only with regard to the executive branch. And that even then has to go in front of the Metro Council and either be voted up or down. And so they would have to vote that down for it to not go into effect, but it's only for the executive.
All right, let me see if this, we'll clarify afterwards, but let me see if this soundbite applies to that. This was something else I heard this morning.
Let's say the Better Together plan passes in November of 2020, but people say, you know what, we don't like the one big police department. How do we go about changing that?
That would be an amendment within the city and the county, or the new metro city, that would require a two-thirds vote.
Okay, so you don't have to go to the statewide vote for that?
No, we need a two-thirds majority.
What do you need the statewide vote for to...
to change features that will be already in here, such as a mayor serving a four-year term, such as elections being held in November rather than, say, April, 33-member legislatures rather than a legislature with a smaller number.
Did he get that right, Dave, in your opinion?
No. There's a few ways. One of the hallmarks, actually, of what the task force wanted to do was make this charter able to respond to the needs of a growing community. You know, one of the reasons we're in this place and, you know, in this spot in the first place is that 100 years ago, somebody thought they had all the answers and put it into the Missouri Constitution. And so we wanted to avoid that. You can actually, an initiative petition just in the city and the county, you need a simple majority to amend the Constitution. It also calls for repeated charter commissions, and their reforms can be adopted by a simple majority. And so the actual charter itself can be amended fairly straightforward and fairly easily. And if the voters decided, hey, we don't want it to be two-thirds for the Metro Council anymore, we just want it to be 50% plus one, they can do that.
Because two-thirds, that's a lot of people getting on board for one particular issue, right? So how would that be changed potentially?
So you could have an initiative petition of citizens in the city and the county, or with the new metro city, just sign a petition and it goes on the ballot and then a majority approves it.
Just and so from the city and the county, or the new metro city, they would say. Yep. So that could be, hey, when we vote on changes in the future, simple majority carries it or something like that.
Correct. Okay. And then, you know, that doesn't even take into account that citizens can put different issues like that from the charter on the ballot and with a simple majority amend the charter that way. And so the idea is, and this is not uncommon, I think in the city it's 3/5 majority. The idea is that you want the legislative body to legislate, but that the charter is something that is meant to have a little bit higher threshold to change. And that's kind of the core of your structure and everything. So
I got it. Yeah, one more thing before I let you go, because this is one of those things that people, when I'm talking to people in the community, whether it's via email or on Twitter or in person, the one thing that keeps coming up, well, there's several things. Obviously, the statewide vote. The second thing is inheriting the city's problems and redistributing the wealth. But the third thing is about Steve Stanger and the extension, essentially, of his term. And it doesn't sit well with a lot of people. And look, I've said before, I don't really like it either, because it seems like it takes the ability for people to elect whoever is running the show to be delayed. Now, I know that you guys thought this through, but you know that that's a sticking point for people, right?
Sure. I mean, we tried to do this in a way that was the best policy. And I think that politics will play into it, but you know, it's not unprecedented. Indianapolis, with Dick Lugar, his term actually was, you know, I think it was 6 months or until the new government is seated even. So it was kind of open-ended. And the reason behind doing that is you either you have one of three options. The mayor or the county executive can have an extended period, or you can have what could be one of the most divisive election cycles in the region's history in the backdrop of this transition when all these leaders are supposed to be working together to implement these reforms.
Well, that would be more fun for me just from an entertainment perspective, but yes.
And so that was the thinking. We knew that, you know, it's the prosecutor, it's the assessor, it's the county executive, the mayor. You know, there are people who were voted for or not voted for by certain people. And so certainly those are going to be issues depending on what people voted. But we really felt that the stability of this was key.
I'm going to let you go there because I'm running way late, Dave. But these are topics that will continue to come up. And I appreciate coming on here this afternoon. I've been told by Nancy Rice, your executive director, that some of the numbers from the plan were taken to the state auditor. And we may have information on that tomorrow. So, Dave, I appreciate it.
Correct. All right, Mark.
All right, take care. It's 2:48. All right, just a couple minutes left in this hour, and I have a little audio I want to get to. I'm really excited to share the Laura Logan audio, which is coming up. She sat down for a podcast interview. She's no longer, I did not know this, she's no longer with CBS News in 60 Minutes, but she candidly talked about media bias and liberal media bias in a way that I've rarely heard outside of my buddy Bernie Goldberg, who was on last week, who wrote a book about media bias called Bias, former CBS guy. But you don't hear reporters being honest about these issues, and she would know. Look, you could sit here and you can hear me explain Exhibit A of media bias, which I do on a regular basis, and we'll kind of, this will be fun for me, I think, because, and hopefully illustrative for you, is I'll match up what Laura says with some examples of media bias from our hometown paper, which is not very difficult to do on a regular basis. So that's coming up in the next hour. On The View this morning, it's amazing how much audio I still get from The Zoo, the definitive political talk show in America, apparently. But in this case, Andy McCabe was on during his book tour, went on 60 Minutes, of course, on Sunday night, was on the Today Show this morning, went on The View this morning as well. And believe it or not, he actually had a tough question from one of the panelists. Now, it came from Meghan McCain. It was not Joy Behar or somebody else or Whoopi, but I thought this was a good exchange.
I don't believe you're a reliable narrator, and I'm not convinced this isn't just some kind of PR campaign to stop yourself from getting indicted. Mm-hmm. You were fired at the recommendation of the FBI, which in your book you cite four times how great of an organization it is for your lack of candor. I would like you to say right here on national TV that you were not a source for the New York Times, you were never a source for the New York Times, or any other publication, considering that's what you're accused of lying about.
All right, so he a lot of people do think that he was the leaker, and I don't know, maybe I just missed this question, if Scott Pelley certainly should have asked him this, and I don't remember that he did, at least not in the segment that I saw. You know, they still have some, I think they call it 60 Minutes Overtime, where they go behind the scenes and you can see a little bit more of those interviews extended form online. His answer, was he the leaker?
Basically, were you ever a leaker to the New York Times?
Absolutely not. No, not in any time ever. You should understand, Megan, when I was serving as deputy director, I was one of two people in the FBI that had the authority to disclose information to the media. That is an FBI policy. It's baked into the way that we run media relations in the organization. So I transacted on issues regarding the media every single day.
Just really quick, then why did James Comey deny the claim that he approved your leaks to the press?
I don't know why Jim Comey doesn't remember the conversations that we had in the same way that I do. It is understandable. He was under an enormous amount of stress at the time. He had a lot of other kind of more important things to worry about. I can't explain why he doesn't remember them the same way I do.
I thought you guys wrote everything down.
We wrote down things when we were dealing with people we didn't trust.
Like the president.
Exactly.
So that's Joy weighing in there at the end. But, you know, her question was legitimate. Wait a second. You guys don't remember these things. Comey wrote everything down when he thought he needed to write things down. But it's very convenient that you don't have that pattern when maybe something was more relevant. So I don't know what to believe with Andrew McCabe. It's hard for me just looking at this sort of from the outside that everything he's saying is a lie. I think there has to be some truth to it. But it's confusing because he's got a credibility issue. Rosenstein says something different. We're probably never going to know the truth. And the bottom line is all these guys want to do one thing, sell books, apparently. That's it. Second hour of the show coming up.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.